Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and it's that time of the week again where I have a conversation with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mudin. This has become one of the most popular segments of our Intelligent Medicine series because we get to bat around back and forth important nutritional controversies and answer listener questions. And by the way, if you want to be part of the action and you have questions to send us, normally we get flooded with questions. We can't just simply sit here like an answering service and type away at our desk and answer public questions, but we will answer them on these Intelligent Medicine podcasts. So email us to a radio program at AOL.com. And once again, to remind you, Layla Mudin is Hoffman Center nutritionist. I work with her on a daily basis. We have shared responsibilities in treating patients. And she is a registered dietitian, and she also holds a master's degree in the field of nutrition. So welcome again to our Intelligent Medicine podcast series, Layla.
Hi, Dr. Hoffman. How are you?
Good. How's it going? So,
okay.
Are you
good.
Sufficiently recovered from last week's seminar at the Hoffman Center? Quite a lot
yes.
of people showed up. It was very nice.
Yeah,
turnout.
That was really, really good. Yes.
And they they tend to have almost sort of a revival meeting fervor. You know, people who are that interested in nutrition show up, and they get real excited learning the details of nutrition. And I was happy to say I even managed to attract my aunt. To come to that. Did you notice that towards the mid, she came a little late. She sidled in
yes,
about
I did.
10 or 15 minutes into your presentation, but she was there nonetheless, and she appreciated it very much. And the subject, once again, was we were talking about, well, what was it again?
It was how to Alzheimer's-proof your brain.
Right, I had forgotten. No,
yeah.
but seriously, folks. So it was very interesting because I found that the audience questions were interesting because one of the points that you made repeatedly was that it's not so much about cholesterol. And then we would get questions from the audience from people saying, well, but what is an acceptable cholesterol?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because I was a little stunned too. But it does take time to unbrainwash ourselves from everything that's been hammered into not just us but everybody. You know, the lay public, all of that stuff. You know, when low carb first kind of started, it took me a little while to wrap my brain around the fact that my bacon and eggs on my plate wasn't going to kill me. That took some time, and that was back in the day. So, you know, we got the cholesterol. It's very, very ingrained.
Nitrite-free bacon. Without
right, nitrate-free bacon, of course, and organic eggs, absolutely. Absolutely.
So, okay, so apropos of that, a big story this week in the medical journals, and I wanted to have you comment on it, is a story out of Sweden. Now, we know that national health programs like those undertaken in the United States often urge us to eat low-fat diets, make sure you get plenty of fruits and vegetables, high fiber, avoid salt, don't eat too much meat, and so on and so on. And Sweden has actually been the first country Sweden's not a primitive country by any means. Very advanced scientifically, a very high standard of living, a very high degree of health and longevity. And they have actually come out with a diametrically opposed recommendation for Swedes, which is to eat a low-carbohydrate diet. Don't worry about meat and eggs. Make sure you have plenty of Swedish meatballs.
Ah, perfect. Well, it's about time. Well, it's been a long time coming. The research has been there, and I guess it needs to be repeated over and over before it becomes established fact here and everywhere else. So, no, I'm not surprised by the finding.
Right.
And neither are you.
Yeah, indeed. But it is. I think it's gratifying. Here's what they say in this news story. They say Sweden has become the first Western nation to develop national dietary guidelines that reject the popular low-fat diet dogma in favor of low-carb, high-fat nutrition advice. This is based on the recommendation of the Swedish Council on Health Technology Assessment. That's probably a little bit like our U.S. Institute of Medicine or maybe the National Institutes of Health.
Yeah.
And they had a committee where they actually exhaustively reviewed all the studies on the relationship between diet and disease. They say that they went through 16,000 studies.
Good for them.
And
wow.
One of their spokespersons, who is a Swedish doctor named, let's see if I can get this right, Andreas Enfeldt, he actually does a health blog in Scandinavia called dietdoctor.com. He says that health markers will improve on a low-carbohydrate diet. He says that you get an increase in your HDL cholesterol. And he also says, get this, butter, olive oil, heavy cream, and bacon are not harmful foods. Quite the opposite. Fat is best for those who want to lose weight.
You need to eat fat to burn fat. It's absolutely true. Now, there's a wonderful example of a country where their public health initiatives follow the truth in science. Gee, I wish that would happen here.
Yeah, I think there's too much politics involved because
I think
when you get recommendations, they get filtered through a process here in the United States where the corn growers and the dairy growers and the meat producers, the wheat board, they all get together and they kind of say,
and the soy council, yep.
And the soy council, no question, because they wield influence as well. There's a very, very tiny room in the corner for the broccoli council. You know, they've got, you know, they have no throw weight at all in this decision-making process.
Yeah.
But all these big agribusinesses and conglomerates get together and they lobby the government. They hire professional lobbyists. So the recommendations you're going to get are pretty much, you know, eat a moderate, balanced diet, you know, make sure you have a little bit of this, a little bit of that, low-fat dairy, blah, 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 you know, that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get these kind of wishy-washy, you know, my plate or the food pyramid recommendations.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's, ultimately, we're all gaining weight.
Right, right. It's very disheartening when I look at the monthly journal I get belonging to the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, the journal for. I'm seeing more and more ads for breakfast cereal. I'm seeing more and more ads for Coca-Cola. It's kind of disheartening to look at all of this.
Actually,
you know.
In Sweden, they featured a commentary from a guy who's a professor of nutrition, Professor Fredrik Nyström from Linköping, Sweden. He's been a long-time critic of the low-fat diet and a proponent of the benefits of saturated fat. And he says that there are many mantras that we've been taught to accept as truths. Calories are calories, no matter where they come from. It's all about the balance between calories in and calories out. People are fat because they don't move enough. Breakfast is the most important meal of the day. And, you know, there's some truth to some of these statements, but, you know, he says, of course, these are true. But this kind of nonsense that a calorie is a calorie is a calorie, and there's no differentiating between calories from, say, Coca-Cola versus calories from olive oil or calories from butter, is what's holding us back in terms of our war against obesity.
It is. It's true. It's true. And I think this is going to take time to die out because even in mainstream nutrition, and I'll even mention you had brought buy a book to me to take a look at and see if it's anything, and unfortunately about calories in, calories out, and I'm like, this was just published?
Right.
People, we need to get over it, you know. So, yeah, this is still going on, and hopefully it'll die.
The job falls upon you sometimes when I get overwhelmed with books to review. I say, you know, take a look at this book, Layla. Is it worthwhile for me to...
Yeah, I actually had to toss it in the garbage.
It literally went right into the circular file because some of the books that are being promulgated these days and that, you know, you can find in, you know, on the shelves of Barnes & Noble or via Amazon.com are, you know, so-called diet books, but they propound ideas that are just, they just don't make scientific sense anymore in light of our new understandings.
Yeah.
So
anyway. A change is a-coming.
Change is a-coming. Okay, hopefully, you know, we will ultimately prevail with common sense.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. And, you know, let me just, a little contretemps to what we're saying here is, you know, some people will take this as license to consume, you know, bacon cheeseburgers with, you know, all kinds of toppings on them, you know, not worry about fat intake.
Well, or a whole package of bacon.
Right.
Or even a whole package of bacon.
That's not what we're saying, though, is it?
That's not what we're saying. No, 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 not at all. I remember seeing, as a matter of fact, in my neighborhood, there's a nice eatery. And under the burger section, they had an Atkins burger where they had the burger with cheese and bacon and a fried egg. And after all, I was like, wow, what are you doing to this burger? It's a little bit insane. So, yeah. It's not licensed to do all of that, although, you know, some people think it's all right. But
isn't that a little bit like the Heart Attack Grill, that place that now has branches in Texas? They have one in Las Vegas. And
Arizona.
In Arizona
too, yeah.
And I
think
their spokesperson actually died recently of a massive coronary.
Yeah.
The waitresses parade around in nurses' costumes.
Mm-hmm.
And, they're making a big joke out of it. There's something to it. You know, that if you consume massive amounts of food altogether,
you're going to get fat.
You're going to get fat.
You're going to die.
But particularly this is something I used to say about the Atkins diet, is that you have, and you know, you actually served as a nutritionist with the late Dr. Robert Atkins,
mm-hmm.
is that I once said that, you know, you can get the best shave from an ultra-sharp samurai sword. Stay with me on this analogy for a minute.
Uh-huh.
But be careful, because if you slip, you could actually slit your throat or cut your head off. And the Atkins diet in some ways is like that. A very ketogenic diet, a very low-carb diet, will just be blown all to hell if you incorporate all that fat and you consume carbohydrates with it. It'll just end up being another high-calorie diet.
Exactly. And the other thing that people take license with is that, oh, I could eat all the calories I want. No! On a low-carb, high-fat, ketogenic diet, you may be able to take in anywhere between 200 and up to 700 more calories a day. That was found more in teenagers, that range, from science done about 15 years ago. But we can't all eat 3,500 calories a day unless we're NFL linebackers.
Right.
You know, we have to be able to burn that, to support that. So, you know, it's not a license to take in all the calories that you can. Like, eat all you can eat, lunchtime buffet or something like that. So, we still have to do things somewhat in moderation. We don't need a 22-ounce steak when an 8 to 12-ounce will suffice.
And that's what I find I'm doing these days.
That's
is that, you know, I went to a really, really fine restaurant the other night, and they had sort of like a mini steak. And that's what I ordered. And I ordered
a petite filet.
Petite filet, and just lots and lots of. I said, you know, let me get extra. You have sides of vegetables. Yes, let's get some extra spinach. Let's get some extra broccoli. Let's have an order of asparagus. And and that was my paleo meal on the run when I was lecturing out in Long Beach, California.
Sounds wonderful.
It was great.
That's perfect. Very filling. Very satisfying. You know.
So shall we get to the questions of the week?
Sure.
Okay. So first of all, do you have any?
Actually, yes, I do. I have one from Dana. Okay. She says, Layla mentioned we don't absorb much calcium from dairy and one can only eat so much green veggies. Dr. Hoffman cautions against more than 800 milligrams calcium combined with supplements. I'd like to take strontium, but the recommendation is to take more calcium than strontium. So how should I approach my calcium intake?
The problem with that question is that there's about five questions in that.
Oh,
question.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean.
And there are a few things that are false here.
Exactly. So
yeah.
Let's dissect that one.
Yeah.
You know,
when I talked about dairy not being the best.
Maybe we should do a little seminar on how to pose a question. Okay. Okay. So, but anyway, I'm not trying to make fun of this person. This person has some real concerns. But let's break it down.
The using dairy as the main source of calcium is not a great idea because dairy also has phosphorus, which can compete with the calcium for metabolism. That's number one. Okay. The calcium
Let me just interject though. I mean, I got to say that. I mean, frankly, if you tolerate dairy and if you're okay with that, and that. Yeah, it depends a little on your genetics and your digestive system, because sometimes people are sick or people are older, they don't digest dairy very well, or if you have an allergy to dairy, which is very frequent, or if you're of a, you know, racial type where dairy really wasn't a part of your heritage, like say you are an East Asian where there's a lot of dairy intolerance, although there are parts of China where they, you know, like Mongolia, where they consume dairy well into adulthood, okay, but you can utilize dairy, and dairy does provide calcium in a pretty bioavailable form.
Yeah.
The problem I have is that all doctors are now saying, oh, women after a certain age, you have to have plenty of milk and plenty of cheese so that you, your bones don't rot away. And we know that that's simply not the case, because there's many societies where they consume virtually no dairy, and yet they have better statistics on osteoporosis than we do. So, you
know,
just
true. And I think we're the highest dairy-eating nation pretty much in the world, and we have the highest rates of osteoporosis. So, you know,
and breast cancer and prostate cancer and so on.
And green veggies are, you know, the dark green leafy vegetables, your kale, your collards, even your broccoli. These are sources of calcium. However, these plant sources also contain phytates or phytic acids, which may bind the minerals, such as iron and calcium, so we don't get as much.
Exactly. So some plants, I mean, some people say, well, Popeye ate spinach. Spinach has iron, so that's going to, instead of eating meat, I'll just eat a lot of spinach. Generally, plants are stingy sources of critical minerals. They do provide a fair amount of magnesium, but they are not the greatest sources of calcium or iron.
That's true. That's true. And, you know, we even have a few vegetarian patients who we're trying very hard to get their ferritin levels up. And if they're only insisting on spinach and peas and lentils, it's not quite doing the trick.
Yeah, we don't see that working very well.
Yeah.
I mean, now, I wish it were the case, but it's just not.
Yeah. What Dana says that you caution against more than 800 milligrams of calcium combined with supplements, I think she mistook this to mean that going, you know, we no longer recommend, you and I, that everybody take 1200 milligrams of calcium every day.
Extra calcium.
Yeah,
right.
Extra, exactly, on top of diet. From the supplementation sources, I think 800 is a cap. What do you think?
Well, here's the deal. I mean, I got to say, this is one of those issues that is confusing. And we have some concerns based on a few studies that suggest that women who consume lots of calcium, or especially additional calcium from supplements, that there's potentially a tendency for that, all that calcium, to go to the wrong place, which would be into your arteries and cause atherosclerosis. We know that calcification is a marker of atherosclerosis, and maybe, just maybe, too much calcium can migrate into the wrong places. And that's from a few preliminary studies. I have to say, though, that this remains controversial, because there's some studies now that show that, you know, taking calcium galore does not promote atherosclerosis. I think, you know, we need to, you know, wait it out, because this is a scientific controversy. It needs to be debated back and forth. But I've actually long foreseen that we were going overboard on calcium. When I developed my supplements foundation formula along with OsteoSupport, you know, when you take both of those together as a woman for prevention of osteoporosis, a multi with the specific osteoporosis prevention product called OsteoSupport, it only provides about, I think it was like 750 milligrams of calcium. So some people would say, well, you know, you're kind of skimpy on that. I said, I have concerns about ODing on calcium. Calcium is a major player, but it is something where cofactors like vitamin D and vitamin K and many other cofactors determine what your body does with the calcium.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, Dana says something I'm a little confused by here. I'd like to take strontium, but the recommendation is to take more calcium than strontium.
I never heard that. I got my ear to the ground on a lot of things regarding strontium, but I never heard that you should take more calcium than strontium. We now recommend strontium citrate, 680 milligrams. That's two capsules of 340 milligram. Strontium at bedtime, taken away from other foods or calcium. And I guess it would turn out that most, you know, it just works out that most people are taking a little more calcium than 680 milligrams.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think there's a hard and fast rule about that.
No. I'm not aware of that myself either. So
right.
No, I think the key is, like you said, to take the strontium away from the calcium.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And for those who can't take the strontium at bedtime, they could be able to take it first thing in the morning if they want that kind of alternate or something.
Yeah.
Some people are.
Here's a frequent complaint, and I think we covered this on a previous podcast. People just don't want to take anything at bedtime. They just don't want to take a glass of water because they're afraid they might wake up and urinate.
Right.
And so that might disturb sleep. So, okay, so keep a bottle of water or a pitcher of water by your bedstand and keep your strontium there. And just first thing on awakening, take your strontium.
There you go.
Get up and read the paper. Wait a few minutes, see if you need to wait an hour or so before you eat.
That's it. Okay. Do you have any questions?
I do.
Yeah.
I do. And, well, here's this actually isn't a question, but this is an observation, okay, because we do this sort of celebrity disease of the week, and last week it was Tom Hanks with his revelation that he had type 2 diabetes, and then we discussed it on the Intelligent Medicine podcasts, and I wrote a blog which was advice to Tom Hanks, which you can find at drhoffman.com, and it was also in our newsletter, so we got a lot of mileage out of that. So this week's celebrity disease of the week is, it actually wasn't announced, but I was looking, I was looking at the tabloids, and they had pictures of, what's the princess's name in England?
Kate Middleton.
Oh, Kate. Okay.
Yes.
Princess Kate.
Mm-hmm.
And Princess Kate, of course, just had a baby, and the baby was just christened. And I think this is a big deal, especially for the ladies, when the royalty, come out. This is, it's 2013, and we're like well past the age of royalty. These people have a purely ceremonial function, but especially women are fascinated every time the royalty appears at some sort of an affair, and what are they wearing? And there are actually entire websites devoted to what is Kate wearing.
Mm.
So there was, I was just looking at some stuff, and I saw, she's decked out in whatever outfit she's wearing, and then there's a close up of her hand to show the type of jewelry that she's wearing. So there's actually, I think there are entire brands of jewelry and clothing that are launched on the basis of what Kate Middleton is using.
Oh, this, yeah, this her like, wedding dress and everything, the designer.
This is like an industry unto itself.
Mm-hmm.
But so I didn't care about the clothing or the jewelry. It didn't, I just blotted that out. I looked at her hands, and very clearly she has eczema. She has eczema.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So now, I had never noticed that before that she had eczema. I mean, I've not had an opportunity to examine her hands, and I've not done like a forensic thing looking at previous photographs, zooming in on the photographs to see if before the pregnancy she had eczema. But there is a phenomenon of postpartum eczema. And so I looked it up. On the internet, you can find anything you want on the internet.
Because everything is true.
And people talk about their problems on the internet on various what are called listservs or exchanges, support groups, and so on. And this is a woman who says, "I've never had eczema in my life, and I'm now dealing with 2 to 3 types of it, largely on my hands. It started up about 4 to 5 months postpartum. Is there any link to that? I mean, I've had 2 other kids, and it didn't spring up after them. I'm just trying to figure out what, quote, caused it, unquote, and if I can expect any relief, and when. My hands can really get out of control, burning and itching, even with prescription ointment." So, but I don't think this was Kate Middleton writing anonymously.
Yeah, this I doubt that, too.
So it must be a common problem. So the... the Duchess of whatever it is. We think she's the Duchess of Cambridge. Is that?
Do we think so? Yeah, I think that's right.
That sounds
okay.
Maybe she's the Duchess of Windsor. So look, I don't follow this stuff.
I don't either.
You're just not keeping up with stuff.
No, you gotta know these.
These are factoids that are very important. Popular culture. Keeping up with the royalty. But, okay, so what advice might we have? Because we do see a lot of cases of eczema. And
yeah.
Let's talk about this phenomenon of postpartum eczema. It appears that pregnancy has kind of does a number on women. Mm-hmm. And what it seems to do, it's unpredictable. It seems to flip the switch on women's immune systems. So therefore, there's some women who get cured of various types of immune problems. They might have ulcerative colitis, and then after pregnancy, it might get better because the immune system becomes more tolerant during pregnancy. The rationale for that is that you've got something inside you that's slightly foreign. It's part of you, but it's also half your husband's DNA. And so you have to become more tolerant to it so you don't your immune system doesn't attack it. So your immune system gets a little suppressed during pregnancy, and that may help certain inflammatory or autoimmune conditions. However, at the end of pregnancy, the immune system may rev up again, and new problems may arise or old problems may come back with a vengeance. So that's, I think, the mechanism here, although it's unpredictable. It's not, you know, why does it happen after, you know, in your third pregnancy, not during your first pregnancy? It's unclear.
Pregnancy hormones can also do a number on yeast overgrowth.
Yes.
Candida.
Thank you.
And that could be something else. You know, a lot of women may suffer with itching, burning, vaginal yeast infection, that type of a thing.
Yeah.
And maybe
lots of estrogen. Estrogen is like rocket fuel for Candida.
Yeah. And as far as autoimmunity, we know that gluten can turn things on in terms of autoimmune reactions. But, yeah, eczema more probably besides autoimmunity, I think is definitely related to Candida. And Candida can also turn on that autoimmune switch.
Right.
Leaky gut and all of that. So intestinal impermeability. Wow. Who knows?
So our advice to Kate Middleton would be to, hop on a plane, come to New York, undergo some allergy tests at the Hoffman Center.
Absolutely.
And, we'll make it a gift to the British people, because we just don't want you to have unsightly hands when you're displaying all that royal bling in the tabloids. But the point being is we would probably do a test for Candida.
Yeah.
We would probably do a test for not IgE, but IgG allergens, because the IgE infrequently turns up positive, except in the few cases with children. We might see a child with very bad eczema, and they might be allergic to eggs, or they might be allergic to wheat or dairy. That test sometimes is a value. We do it anyway, just to see if it turns up positive. Often it's negative, but the IgG test might give us clues. And we do also anti-gluten antibody testing to see if there's a sensitivity to gluten. It's often a good idea. I mean, even if you can't go to the doctor, if you can't be tested, it's often a good idea to just get off of gluten and see if that does make a difference, because it's such an important allergen.
Yeah. The other thing, I think it would be appropriate for her to be on a Candida diet,
right.
Eat as little sugar and starch as possible, gluten-free or not,
right.
As little sugar and starch as possible, because if the source is Candida overgrowth, Candida feeds on refined sugar as well as starch and other carbohydrates, so that would have to be watched. Well, I believe Kate Middleton also did the French version of the Atkins diet. I forget that doctor's name.
Oh, okay.
Before she got married, to get herself ready for the wedding.
She probably did all the popular
Duquesne
diets.
Duquesne, was it?
Dr. Duquesne, yes. That's
I think
right.
so. Yeah.
Well, what is that?
That's similar.
Is that
it's similar to a Candida diet because it would be low in carbohydrate.
Well, maybe she could get back on the wagon with that. The other thing is, I mean, both of us sit down and interrogate patients about what they eat. And I would
be
worried.
Ways of making you talk.
Exactly. You have that very bright light that you shine on the patients, and sometimes we apply the thumb screws. But I would ask her, are you consuming any fish, especially oily fish? Are you consuming nuts, which might be a source of omega-3 fatty acids? And, then we might act as a neat test that we do on many patients with skin conditions. We do essential fatty acid profiles. And especially when we see this in young kids, eczema children, they're very finicky eaters. They don't have any omega-3 fatty acids in their bloodstream. That means their skin is very dry and very susceptible to inflammation. So by then replacing the omega-3s, giving them fish oil, EPA and DHA, or alternatively GLA, which is actually an omega-6 oil, that's from borage oil, that can be very helpful for eczema.
Absolutely. And getting anybody who's having junk food, especially kids and their corn chips, or what do we like to call it, cornography, all those various vegetable oils, the peanut oil, the safflower oil, the soybean oil, these are omega-6s that are that displace all the omega-3s that they need for their skin as well. But not the good quality GLA. These are more the inflammatory omega-6s rather than the good stuff, like in borage oil and CLA.
We might also check for vitamin D. And, you know, knowing that the royal physicians might be very, very conservative about vitamins and supplements, although her father-in-law is really gung-ho about natural medicine, Prince Philip.
Wow.
Or Prince Charles, excuse me, Prince Charles.
Uh-huh.
Philip
uh-huh.
is the grandfather who barely can get around anymore. But Charles, they criticize him very frequently because he says what they consider the most outlandish things about homeopathy. They just think he's a whack job because he's totally into complementary and alternative medicine there.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah. He's been very pilloried because of his views about natural medicine. But you know how it is when the parents and grandparents often can't really prevail on their kids to take this perspective. So he must be wringing his hands. He's probably saying, my goodness, Kate, you've got to get yourself to a homeopath.
Uh-huh.
And Kate's probably saying, I don't believe in that.
Yeah.
So
pass the ointment.
Yep, right. Pass the steroid cream.
Pass the steroid cream, exactly.
Okay. So we got another question from somebody. I think it was via the internet. You have that question?
It's about
microwaving.
Oh, right. Here we go. This is from Francine. And
this is from Facebook. She posted it on Facebook.
Yeah.
Look, I can't answer all these questions on Facebook. I mean, if I answered every question on Facebook, you know, I just wouldn't even leave.
You'd just be on Facebook all day long.
Facebook all day long. I wouldn't see any patients. I wouldn't do my broadcast. I'd just be the answer man on Facebook. So I said, look, fine. Thank you for your question. We're going to put it in the context of a podcast. That way, a lot of people can learn from it.
So Francine says, have read loads of the dangers of microwave cooking, even with safe glass containers. Is this alarmist, or should I avoid microwave cooking? I'm perplexed.
All right, your take on that.
Well, first of all, glassware would be the vehicle of choice to put anything
in
a microwave.
I'd be afraid
of plastic.
Yeah, this I don't understand because glass is very stable. I mean, I think we need a little basic science here, folks. Glass, you know, if you microwave it or heat it up, you're not going to leach anything from the glass into the product. I mean, there may be, like, with some poor quality pottery from Mexico that's made with lead glaze, that could be a concern, but not with a Pyrex dish. Mm-hmm. So that if you're going to microwave something, that actually is the most sensible way to microwave something. What I have a concern about is that, you know, why don't you go into the whole issue of the additives in plastic?
Yeah, the BPA, the bisphenol A, for instance, that's also what we call a gender bender, an endocrine disruptor. It imitates our sex hormones, estrogen especially, and all of that. And there's BPA leaching from the plastic, whether it's plastic wrap, plastic bowl, your Tupperware. Shouldn't put your lunchtime Tupperware in the microwave. Transfer it to a glass bowl. That would be better. I'm a little bit afraid of all the plastic.
Yeah, recently I was in the supermarket. I was shopping, and there was this woman I was in the detergent aisle because I wanted to get some, you know, toilet bowl cleaner. I was on a mad campaign to clean my apartment that day, and on the opposite side is all kinds of, you know, containers and aluminum foil and saran wrap and all this stuff. And there was this woman talking to another woman saying, oh, these are great. You've got to get one of these. It's fantastic. You put all your vegetables in there, and then you put in a tablespoon of water, and you seal it, and then you put it in the microwave, and then you've got a whole meal, steamed vegetables. It's fantastic. And, you know, the other woman she was totally not interested. She didn't want to get the thing. So this poor woman was trying to convince her friend that this is a really great way to nuke her vegetables. So, you know, I went over, I took a look at it, and the first thing I said to myself was, like, what kind of junk is in that plastic that, you know, when you turn on the microwave, it's going to leach right into the vegetables.
Yeah.
And what I noticed was, it was kind of interesting, it was on the label, it said BPA free.
Mm.
Now, that does not mean that it doesn't have other harmful phthalates and other harmful plasticizers.
Yes.
I mean, that,
yes, so, absolutely.
So to me, that doesn't exonerate that product. I probably, that I would not recommend, because the high energy of the microwave and the heat might cause other harmful substances to leach from the plastic into the food. Mm. So that being said, what can you say about the quality of the food after it's been microwaved? Have you looked into this issue at all? I mean, because just let's say that it's in a glass container and you're heating up your leftovers from yesterday. Do you have a problem with that?
I don't have a problem with that, as long as it's a glass container. And it's in there, it's in the microwave. When you're reheating, it's only for a minimal amount of time. It may retain more of its nutrients. There's that as well.
Right.
And, ask anybody who's got a microwave or who's had a microwave for at least 10 years, they're not going to give it up.
Right. Thank you for taking a very practical view on this. And I agree with you, because I've looked at the science of microwaving, and some people claim that microwaving in some ways tears the food up or damages the intrinsic properties of foods. And that's a reasonable hypothesis, because it's a very high energy form of cooking. It's not natural, like regular heating with a fire, with like a flame, or even electrical heat under your pot, where you steam or boil something. And so I actually looked at it, and what appears to happen is that any time you cook food, you do actually leach some, especially water soluble vitamins and minerals from the food.
You denature the proteins as well.
And you do. Yes, you do.
Denaturing proteins means cooking.
Yeah, that's called cooking.
Yeah.
But what you do, let's look at the science. You break it down into the components, the amino acids, and, it's impossible to destroy a mineral. I guess it's possible to destroy a vitamin. But actually, studies show that you preserve a pretty high level of nutritional value. Now, some people are going to scream at us for saying, oh, microwaving is okay, because they're the real hardcore people who believe that microwaving is something really terrible. I got to say that it doesn't make the food radioactive. It doesn't turn the food into Frankenfood. And, another thing is that take, for example, kale. Kale, raw kale. Yeah, they have raw kale salads now where they use the young kale, and that's pretty good.
Baby kale, yep.
Baby kale. That's easy to chew. But, take a kale that's been sitting there for a really long time, and you want to chew that up, you're going to grind your teeth away, and it's going to be a pretty unpleasant experience. You steam that kale, and then maybe saute it in olive oil, you're going to liberate a lot more of the nutrients that are there.
Same with tomatoes.
Yeah,
raw tomato, we don't get the lycopene as we do when it's been processed a little bit, meaning cooked a little bit, or even juiced, for that matter. So, yeah.
So I got to say that I am not...
I'm not anti-microwave.
Not anti-microwave.
I'm anti-plastic.
And we're living in the real world, and, you and I, we both spend, I think, we exercise a lot of care with our food preparation, our food selection. Because this is our profession. But when it comes to, some modern labor-saving devices, we don't cook every meal de novo, right?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you want to heat up something that's a leftover. Today, for lunch, I made some really great lamb burgers. Organic ground lamb, which, by the way, is very expensive, but I got it. You have sources. So what I did is I got fresh rosemary and oregano from my garden. It's still, it was still viable a few weeks ago when I picked it, and I kept it in the refrigerator. And I chopped some garlic, and I added some mint leaves, chopped mint leaves, and that imparted a wonderful flavor and aroma to the lamb burgers.
Wonderful.
So, but there's some leftover ones, and darn if I'm not going to nuke those in the microwave when I have them, tomorrow.
I will reheat my dinner from the previous night. I won't put a chicken or a meatloaf cook from raw in the microwave. I won't do.
There you go.
It's for reheating.
Yeah, because I just don't like the cooking properties. I think it cooks in a very ununiform way, and there's a high potential to dehydrate it and turn it into cardboard.
It does. It does. Yeah. It cooks the outside first. It's a little bit strange. And you know what the microwave is used
for? It cooks the inside first, actually.
But something else happens, and the dehydration, and then the texture changes. And you know what the microwave is used mostly for?
No.
Reheating a cup of coffee.
Thank you. I've got this big old fancy microwave with all kinds of, like, you know, algorithms and instructions on how to, you know, convection. And most of the time I just set it on 1 minute, you know, take some cold coffee out of the pot and reheat.
That's it.
That's what I'm going to do after I finish this podcast.
Yeah.
Okay, so do we have any other questions?
I think my questions are done.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so basically, you know, I think that's it. What do we have to look forward to? We're going to schedule another podcast. I'm sorry, another seminar for. We're going to do this at the beginning of January.
It's going to be in mid-January. As a matter of fact, the confirmed date is Wednesday, January 15.
Okay, so say the date. We'll announce that. We've got a newsletter. You know, each week we put out the Intelligent Medicine newsletter. And this week, you know, I'll send this article to you momentarily. I'm completing an article on. It has to do with the influence of the internet on our health. And there's some interesting stories this week about that. I'm going to comment on those stories. First of all, we're going to talk about what's called cyberchondria, which is a condition that people develop when they read about too many diseases. It's a real deal. I mean, some people get a little nuts with all that information out there. We're also going to talk about, you know, the American Academy of Pediatrics came out with a recommendation. A lot of good it's going to do, but it's a recommendation that we ration kids' use of devices. I mean, years ago they came out with a recommendation that we ration kids' TV exposure. But what they're discovering now is that kids are glued to these devices, that little kids are walking around with cell phones, that they're on the computer, and, you know, mealtime is just, you know, mom and dad read their email, and they're, you know, get in touch with their virtual office, and the kid sits down and then plays with their device. And there's virtually no communication happening. So it's like it's a developmental roadblock. It's causing what they call digital dementia.
Oh, my goodness.
People are becoming brain dead. And apropos of that, I'll also include some stuff. I talked to Camilla Reese this week, who's a big an EMS EMF expert. She's an expert on the harmful effects of electromagnetic fields. And her contention is that there's a lot of harmful effects from cell phones, especially with kids. Her specialty is kids, pregnancy, and fertility, and she's really concerned about the effects of electronic media, iPads, iPhones, tablets, on human health, and especially for developing kids. So we'll talk a little bit about that in the newsletter.
You know, I've also heard that in Denmark that it's illegal for anyone below under the age of 18 to use a cell phone. I think it's Denmark. Denmark.
I'm going to move to Scandinavia because they advocate the use of butter and fat and meat, and they also are they're trying to limit cell phones.
There you go.
They're
for
way
people
ahead.
Under the age of 18, yes.
That is going to be a really tall order.
Yeah.
Good luck with that.
Yeah.
Just like, you know, the cat's out of the bag on that one. And, you know, the statistic is really scary because they estimate that kids, get this, they spend about 7 hours a day doing social media, texting, and very little very little phone calling anymore. It's all about, you know, texting.
Yeah, yeah. And with kids, you know, they'll be sitting next to each other and texting each other rather than talking.
Right. Or alternatively, you know, lights out, time to go to bed. You know, in old days, I would get under the covers with like a flashlight and read a comic book.
Uh-huh.
Now it's like, okay, you got an internet connection, you got a device, and it's like texting, or, you know, if you are a male over the age of 12, you've got a whole world of pornography to tune into. So, you know, good luck. Good luck, you parents.
Parental controls, please.
Yeah, let's see if we can. I don't know. Take back that realm is going to be very tough.
Wow.
Right.
Well,
so we'll
the original device was the television.
Yep, that's when it all got started.
Yeah.
And, you know, our generation is the first who were immersed in TV. I was absolutely mesmerized by TV from the time I was probably about two. So that's how it is.
I remember my black and white TV. Oh, my goodness, black and white. And then when we got a color TV, that was amazing.
That's right. It took us a long time to get a color. The color TV, that was the killer app of 1960.
Oh, yeah.
It was all over after that. The first time I saw Star Trek in color, I was gone. I was literally sucked into the screen and forever addicted. What can I tell you?
Oh, my goodness.
So anyway, we're going to talk a little bit about that in our newsletter. For those of you who want to subscribe, it's radioprogram@AOL.com. Request the newsletter. And check out our website at drhoffman.com. By the way, I'm reviewing... Yeah, like I said, it's like kitchen remodeling. We're almost there with the brand new website. It's going to be great, but it's going to take another couple of weeks to nail it down. It's going to be very user-friendly, and there's going to be all kinds of information there.
Looking forward to that.
Looking forward to that. And we also have a Twitter feed, and friend me on Facebook. On Twitter, you can follow me at Dr. Ronald Hoffman. So it's at Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and we have plans for the Broadway musical as well. What role have you decided to play in the Hoffman Center Broadway musical? We're going to start off Broadway.
I'll play nutritionist.
We're actually going to do. Are you play nutritionist?
You'll I'm play. I'm going to play nutritionist.
Okay, you're a little typecast. Why don't you reach a little bit for for dramatic effect? I mean, you could be like the cruel stepmother, or you could be the you could be the crack addicted daughter. You know?
Oh my goodness!
Just go against type. Anyway, all right. So we're just having fun here. Check out our newsletter and follow us on Facebook, Twitter. Thank you very much for joining us, and thanks, Layla, for putting up.
Thank you, Dr. Hoffman.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.